ASU is expanding its downtown Phoenix presence, officially breaking ground on a new law school building. What'll this do to the town and gown relationship?
I think if we can keep the pressure, we on the outside can keep the pressure on ASU to be open and be urban serving, then I think the result will be positive.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, the latest twists and turns in the Navajo presidential election, how a U.S. trade deal with China could affect Arizona, and using poetry to get kids to speak up.
We have the gift, the blessing, to be able to go in and perform and catch their attention, unveil to them this truly transparent story. This is who I am. This is what I'm giving to you.
Plus, a new approach to deal with childhood poverty and a legendary kitchen prepares its last meal.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for tonight, it'll stay partly cloudy. We're looking for lows to be around 60, and that is going to bring with us kind of a cooling trend. It'll be partly to mostly sunny tomorrow with a high of 79, and then mostly sunny skies on Saturday with a high of 74. It's currently partly cloudy and 80 degrees.
The second open enrollment period for health insurance through the federal marketplace opened Saturday. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports people who bought plans last year have to choose insurance again this year.
The marketplace offers new plans and new insurance companies. Individuals can renew their plan if it still exists, but there may be better options. Diane Brown is with the Arizona Public Interest Research Group, which helps educate young adults on insurance options.
It's important to keep in mind that the health insurance marketplace exists of private insurance companies. This is not government insurance. And so just like any other product in the marketplace, plans change, products change from year to year.
Brown says it's important for people renewing or choosing new plans to make a decision before the enrollment period ends in February. If consumers don't and lose their insurance, they'll have to pay the penalty, which increases this year to 2% of an individual or family's income. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Two lawyers for the Phoenix woman accused of leaving her two young sons in a hot car during a job interview are off the case. Maricopa County Superior Court documents show Shanisha Taylor has been assigned a public defender after a judge granted her lawyer's motions to withdraw. Benjamin Taylor says he had an ethical conflict with his client, while another lawyer says Shanisha Taylor did not pay him. She was arrested in March after her sons were left in her car for about 45 minutes in Scottsdale. She received more than $114,000 in donations after her tearful mugshot went viral.
Authorities say an airline pilot reported spotting a drone about a dozen miles from Sky Harbor Airport. Federal Aviation Administration spokesman Ian Greger says the pilot reported seeing the unmanned aircraft while inbound to Sky Harbor late this morning. Details about the drone itself, its altitude, and proximity to the airliner aren't immediately known, but Greger says the pilot didn't mention taking evasive action. The president of Liberia, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, has lifted the state of emergency imposed over the Ebola outbreak in the country. In a national address, Mrs. Johnson Sirleaf said the move did not mean the fight against Ebola was over. She said Liberians should still remain vigilant. The number of new cases has dropped in the country, which has seen more than 2,800 people dying from the disease so far. The BBC's Mark Doyle is in West Africa and monitoring developments.
Experienced aid workers in the region say the main reason the number of cases has dropped in Liberia is a change in behavior by Liberians. They've improved hygiene measures and isolated Ebola patients in their communities. The aid workers say this change in behavior contributed more to the drop in caseload in Liberia than international interventions. The president's speech appears to be good news for Liberia. But the Ebola epidemic is still growing in neighboring Sierra Leone and Guinea.
That's the BBC's Mark Doyle.
The controversy surrounding the Navajo presidential election continues. KJZZ's Laurel Morales joins me now for the latest. Hi, Laurel.
Hi.
So what's going on today?
So Myron McLaughlin filed a complaint against Russell Begay, the third place finisher who is currently on the ballot, facing off against Joe Shirley Jr. But Myron McLaughlin was also in the primary. He finished eighth. He's filed a complaint against the third place finisher, Russell Begay, because of his involvement with the Navajo Nation Oil and Gas Company. Begay was a shareholder with the company, and the grievance says that Begay wrongfully received stipends. It also questions Begay's loyalty to the tribe because he was a party to a federal lawsuit that sought to overturn a decision by the tribe's Supreme Court that would have reinstated the companies, the Navajo Nation oil and gas companies, CEO and board. So currently there's a possibility that Begay could also be disqualified or step down.
Now, Begay is only on the ballot because Chris Descheny had already been disqualified over a controversy surrounding his fluency in the Navajo language. If Begay is then disqualified, would the fourth place primary finisher then move up to the general election?
That is a possibility, yes. This has never happened before. And so currently the election law does not define the steps if Begay is disqualified. But if Begay steps down or is disqualified and the fourth place finisher is put on the ballot, it becomes a father against son race. Currently, Joe Shirley Jr.'s running mate is Danae Benally, and he's the son of the fourth place finisher, Donald Benally. So it just gets better and better.
So what is the judge looking at?
The judge is hearing arguments today. Begay's attorney calls this complaint a smear campaign and says none of the allegations would disqualify him. Myron McLaughlin's attorney, says they have a serious reason to disqualify Begay, and we'll find out in the next day or two. Now, the Navajo presidential election is tentatively set for December 23rd, so we could get a new Navajo president for Christmas, but we're still not sure what the ballot looks like yet. So there's also great potential that it could be postponed once more.
KJZZ's Laurel Morales. Laurel, thanks.
Thank you.
In 2006, the Arizona Corporation Commission implemented a standard requiring the state's public utilities to produce 15% of its energy through renewable sources by 2025.
But as incentives have faded away, the idea of reducing the renewable standard or extending the timeline in Arizona has been floated.
Arizona isn't alone in trying to figure out how much of its energy needs need to come from renewable sources. ASU professor Martin Pasqualetti, whose work focuses on energy policy, says the EPA's push to reduce carbon emissions should impact the use of renewables across the country.
Every state has to adjust to these new standards, and there will be some pushback, I assume, on all those. Arizona has to come up with about a 52 or 53% reduction in the 2005 emissions of CO2. Well, part of the portfolio of options to reach that new standard, whatever it ends up being in the final rule, is going to be renewable energy. That is one of the ways that standard can be met. And the other part of this is the arrangement between, or the announcement the other day between China and the United States with regard to reducing CO2. So now we have the two biggest emitters, and both of them are going to be, I would suspect, pushing renewable energy even more.
At this point, how is Arizona doing compared to other states, including the big ones in the West?
Around the United States, Arizona has put in several very large developments. Most of these are rate-based. They're going into the grid and the power purchase agreements are with the local utility companies, mostly APS. That's very encouraging. I don't know that that is going to continue unless there's continued incentives from the government. In California, there is an incentive because they have what we have. We have a renewable portfolio standard, renewable energy standard. We have only 15% by 2025. They have more like 33%. So, and they're pushing that even more. They also have requirements for energy storage to help offset some of the disadvantages of renewables being intermittent. So many states have more aggressive, I think, portfolio standards than we do. We were very good in the beginning, and we set, in fact, a bar that other states now have been able to jump over.
When you hear even the idea floated that, well, Arizona jumped a little bit too far ahead, and now we're looking at it, and the commission is thinking, based on whatever reasons, we don't necessarily know what the reasons are, maybe Arizona needs to pull back from that. What's your first reaction?
Utility companies are saying, well, not everybody is paying into the system, but they're all having the reliability of the grid, so therefore they should pay more for having solar. I think that's the interim position for utility companies, and utility companies will need to make adjustments within the business plan to allow this to work in a better way. That is, that they, instead of opposing it, they need to get on board, I think, with this and see how they can perhaps make money doing this. So APS has actually got a proposal in now to the Arizona Corporation Commission to allow them to do, I think, 3,000 rooftops. So they're, in a sense, becoming a competitor. They're trying to figure out exactly how they can move into the future and not put themselves out of business. If we can help the utility companies make money and push renewables, that's the answer. That's the holy grail piece right now.
ASU professor Martin Pasqualetti, whose work focuses on energy policy. Relationships between police officers on college campuses and students can be tense. That can also extend to residents of nearby neighborhoods. And in the case of Arizona State University, that includes all four Valley sites. ASU's new police chief, Mike Thompson, says one of his goals is to improve communication.
In a university environment, we are constantly engaged with the same customers over and over. Not to say that those people are doing something wrong, but we may be sitting on committees with them. We may be helping them with some kind of project that they're doing. There's just a lot of opportunities to work with the community that we're, you know, surrounded by.
What's the relationship like between a campus force and a city force?
Yeah, so we work with all of our different Valley agencies that we bump up against, and you can imagine that our students live and work on campus, and then they go out into the community outside of the campus. And so you can imagine that we have to have a very strong relationship between ourselves and the municipal agencies that we're dealing with. And although all the police officers that work at Arizona State University Police Department are all certified by Arizona POST, which is Arizona Police Officer Standards and Training, which is the same certifying board for all municipal agencies in the state of Arizona. We all have the same training, but we do have a little bit different a mission at ASU PD than as opposed to another municipal agency. So there is a lot of cooperation between the two of us. Just recently, this last year, we've really increased the cooperation between ourselves and the City of Tempe Police Department. They're more involved in our large-scale activities that impact their city. And so we've really established a great partnership there, and it's really been beneficial to both sides, I believe.
How do you generate trust? A lot of students. So how do you make it clear to all the students, or as many as you can, that you're kind of in this together, that there are certain responsibilities that everybody faces, but that they can count on the campus force for minor things, whether it's something horrible like a sexual assault, that kind of thing, that there is this good connection there?
Yeah, we've been doing a lot of different things. The more involved we can be with student organizations, student government, different communities within our ASU campus, the better. And we've made a lot of strides in that way. But you're absolutely right. In order for us to be very effective on the campus, we have to have those relationships of trust built within that. And that is just a matter of getting out there and being visible and meeting with students. One thing that we did add this year is a new app for your phone. It's called LiveSafe. It's free to all students and anybody who's visiting the ASU campus. And what it does is it enables the student or visitor, whoever, faculty member, to be able to send a text message directly into our dispatch center, and our dispatch center can text directly back to that student or person and have a two-way conversation with them. And we get all kinds of comments from, you know, hey, somebody's smoking in this area and they're not supposed to be smoking, to I have a question about my roommate, is this allowed, you know, things like that. So any of those two-way communications, especially through social media and through the techie type generation that we're dealing with, is better. So I think that's been a very positive move in that direction.
So as we talked about the university being so big, part of that includes a lot of diversity. Obviously, there was the professor, Ursula Orr, and there were some issues there. Is there more effort being done to be more racially sensitive?
Well, I would say that we have been doing a lot more training recently, and in fact, not because of just that incident, but just some other things that I had noticed that we needed to change the culture of the department. And so it's not aimed so much racially, but just being more customer service oriented, taking our customer service to a new level than where we've been in the past. And of course, being at a university, I tapped right into my resources. And so I have some really top-notch professors and things that have come together and actually conducted some classes for us, which we've been working through. So we've done quite a bit since some of that, incidents happened.
ASU's new police chief, Mike Thompson. Neighborhoods near ASU's Tempe campus are affected by student behavior and the presence of law enforcement. Longtime resident and activist Karen Gitlis says police and law-abiding citizens are working together well.
There are lots of ways we collaborate with the police department, and effectively, we have actually been effective in catching criminals by just word of mouth and social media. The best safety and prevention factor is our eyes on the street. And if we think it's suspicious, report it.
Do you think enough communication is made among the community, including police, to make it real clear to students what they are allowed to do and not allowed to do, regardless of what the letter of the law says, and how that affects the surrounding neighborhood, which has been an important part of Tempe for many years?
I think that is moving along. I think there are always ways that can be improved. I think ASU is doing a grand job. There was a joint committee that met with the Tempe police and the ASU police and students to talk about just those kinds of things and what the university is doing to improve these communications and the training that needs to happen before the students move into their dorms. Living in the neighborhood close to the university, I can say that the best training we have is kind of being the house moms and house dads. And I know I have tenants myself, so I get to do this kind of on hands. And telling them what the expectations are. It's great if you have a party, as long as you don't advertise it on social media, to the world, to your friends is one thing. And these are the expectations when you have that party. This is when we want the noise levels to go down. This is how loud we want the band to be amped. This is what you need to do the next morning. You're always standing on the side of the angels if you knock on doors around your house and tell the neighbors that this is going to be happening.
Four-decade Tempe resident and activist Karen Gitlis.
Still to come, a Tempe institution gets ready to close its doors and its kitchen.
I grew up around here. I love the tradition. I love the history. But my love of nostalgia isn't enough to sustain an obsolete business model.
We say goodbye to Monty's ahead on the show.
Good afternoon. In Valley traffic, only one thing to tell you about. Inexplicably heavy slowing on the 101 northbound in the East Valley from Indian School up to about Shea. Looking for partly cloudy skies for tonight around the valley. With low temperatures around 60, we will cool off considerably over the next few days. Look for a high tomorrow of 79. Over the weekend, high temperatures in the lower to mid-70s. Currently with relative humidity at 36%, it's partly cloudy and 80 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by APS. Next for APS means looking forward and being ready to meet Arizona's future energy needs. Next is technology that makes the electricity grid safer and smarter. APS.com/next. The future of energy is bright.
It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. We're going to take a look now at the Affordable Care Act and the recent announcement by the U.S. Supreme Court to hear a case about the validity of the federal health care exchanges. Here's the takeaways, Todd Zwillick.
Take just a second here now and listen to MIT health economist Jonathan Gruber. He helped the White House draft parts of the Affordable Care Act, and here he's speaking at a conference about some of the tactics Democrats used in writing the law. Listen.
lack of transparency is a huge political advantage. And basically, you know, call it the stupidity of the American voter or whatever. But basically, that was really, really critical to getting the thing to pass.
As you can imagine, that clip and others from Gruber are getting tons of play in conservative media, used as confirmation that the Affordable Care Act was nothing more than one big ruse. Now, Gruber there is talking about some of the more arcane parts of the ACA and how they affect budgeting and deficits and other effects on the law. But what he's really saying is that the law is so complex, so riddled with technicalities and political jargon, that it might be purposefully vague in some places. And it kind of gets to the heart of why the Affordable Care Act is landing right back in front of the Supreme Court this term in a case that hinges in a lot of ways on just four words. Now, those four words, some people say, are just a drafting error, an innocent mistake by some staffer who put pen to paper on the law. Others say it's just the kind of subterfuge that Jonathan Gruber has been talking about into microphones. Well, any which way, those four words could determine the fate of all federally run exchanges, which operate now in 36 states across these United States. So for more on that case, we turn to Timothy Jost. He's law professor at Washington and Lee University and author of Health Law, a widely read law school text. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
So first, the four words. I'll throw them out there. Those four words are established by a state. The Affordable Care Act says that exchanges shall be established by a state. And if you don't like the Affordable Care Act, that means that any exchange like the big, giant federal one with subsidies isn't any good because it's not established by a state.
Well, the Affordable Care Act does say in Section 1311 that states shall establish exchanges. In Section 1321, the statute says if a state elects not to establish an exchange, the Department of Health and Human Services shall establish such exchange, which is to say the federally facilitated exchange steps in and is there in the place of the state exchange. It becomes effectively the state exchange. And if you read many other sections of the statute, that is clear. The federal exchange is the exact equivalent, is effectively the same as the state exchange. So what we've got here is some people who really don't like this statute, who would really like to get rid of this statute, finding four words of the statute, picking those four words out of the statute, and ignoring the other 900 and some pages of the statute. If you read the statute as a whole, as the Supreme Court should, according to its own precedent, then they're not going to have a problem with this case. It's clear that the federal exchanges, federally facilitated exchanges, can issue premium tax credits.
Well, doesn't that first section that you mentioned, which says established by a state, also provide for the types of subsidies that are so key to keeping this law going? When people don't have enough money to pay their premiums, they get subsidies. And in this case, it's read that you can only get them if you have a state exchange.
That's not true. That's not what the statute says. This language comes out of a particular section dealing with how to calculate the subsidies. And in that section, it does, at a couple of places, use this terminology. But if you look at Section 1413 of the statute, it says that the administration shall ensure that the residents of each state have access to premium tax credits. It's clear that the federally facilitated exchange, the fallback exchange, becomes the state exchange if a state elects not to establish its own exchange. And this was clear to the states. This is not an issue of text versus some kind of fuzzy-headed notion of legislative intent. This is text versus text, text versus context. You have to read the text of the entire statute. And if you do that, it's clear. We've counted four dozen provisions in the statute that either don't make sense or make a lot less sense if the federally facilitated exchanges can't grant premium tax credits. You'd have to throw out a lot of the statute if all you're going to do is read those four words. And that's not the way the court has said you should read statutes.
You know, Professor, a lot of people make the point that the Supreme Court wouldn't have skipped all the circuit courts and disagreements in the circuit and taken this case so fast if they didn't intend to knock the ACA down here.
Yeah, I think a lot of people believe that the four justices who tried to get rid of the Affordable Care Act in the NFIB case are looking for a second shot at it. And that might be true. On the other hand, the argument of the plaintiffs when they requested certiorari in this case was that this was an issue that was urgent, that needed to be decided right now, that there was too much uncertainty. And it may be that the justices of the Supreme Court agreed to that, that this is something we've got to get settled one way or the other, and that we shouldn't let it drag out for another year or two.
Well, cherry picking on the one hand versus rich context of statutory reading on the other. Professor Timothy Jost, law professor at Washington and Lee University, thanks for helping us understand the second time that the Affordable Care Act seems to hang in the balance there at the Supreme Court. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways, Todd Zwillick. More than half of the kids in Arizona younger than 8 live in low-income families, the fifth highest percentage in the country. That's one of the findings from a new Kids Count policy report, which calls for a two-generation approach to dealing with childhood poverty. Dana Wolf-Namark is president and CEO of Children's Action Alliance and says the theory is that by helping parents, you can, by extension, help their kids.
I think we have some aspects of already doing two-generation approaches, but this is putting more of a spotlight on it and saying we'll have more chance for success if we really think about kids and their parents at the same time.
How is Arizona doing as far as trying to take this approach?
Well, we have some small, wonderful efforts, but they're not to scale. And I think we've got the seeds of success here in a few areas. We do a lot of professional mentoring of parents right in their own homes. Arizona has had this for many years, and they're very successful, but still small and spotty. So it's a challenge to bring it to scale and make sure more families can benefit. And what's so great about that is you're not putting families into these buckets and saying, we're here today to talk about immunizations, or we're here today to talk about parenting skills. It's all mixed in together, and you really help families with their biggest challenges and their biggest goals at the same time. So you're helping parents to be ready and successful in the workforce and helping them to improve their parenting at the same time.
How much do state-run services like child care subsidies and some of those play into this?
Child care subsidies is a critical two-generation approach. Obviously, by definition, if you're helping parents afford child care that they choose, you're helping them be good and stable workers in the workforce and helping them have quality educational places for their children to be while they're at work. So it is a prime example of a two-generation approach that, as probably many of your listeners know, Arizona has let that deteriorate during the recession. We've started a little bit of rebuilding, and I think that should be a top priority for the new governor and new legislature to rebuild that even more.
I would imagine that ultimately the most important thing that one can do in this situation is make sure that parents have jobs, yes?
Yes, that's one main thing. Another one is to make sure parents have tools to be better and stronger parents. As the saying goes, babies don't come with instruction manuals, and we all can use help in parenting skills and coping strategies. Some parents struggle more than others if they don't have a support network.
Do those kinds of services tend to come from the state? Are they public services, or do they tend to come from other private organizations?
It's a combination. And in Arizona, we have a very privatized system, which is a strength. So even services that may have funding from the state are usually delivered by very community-based organizations. And there's philanthropic funding and community support that contributes to that.
Are you concerned about the future of child care subsidies, other programs from the state, job creation perhaps itself, knowing that the state is facing down potentially a $1 billion budget deficit?
We face huge challenges, obviously, with how do we balance the budget and achieve our goals for children's health, education, and security. So we are going to need to come together with a lot of creative ideas and a lot of determination to make sure that those goals stay at the top of the list.
Dana Wolf-Namark is president and CEO of Children's Action Alliance. Dana, thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Jason Brennan. I'm here at C2 Tactical. I'm the sales manager here. I'm also an instructor. I'd had some bad headaches. My blood pressure was like pre-stroke. It was very bad. I looked into shooting, and shooting helped me with my blood pressure. It helped lower it. It helps your stress levels. It calms you down, so to speak, really, realistically, if you're comfortable with it. And yeah, I haven't had a blood pressure incident in the past 4 years. I like most about shooting is the accomplishments of center shot targets, being extremely accurate. And the instruction part, too, is a lot of fun. Teaching someone how to do something is awesome. You get a lot of enjoyment out of it. Find someone that comes in and they may be scared of firearms. Maybe they had a bad experience with them. If you can give them the security of, you know, to be able to be safe with them, it's awesome.
That's Jason Brendan instructing shooting classes at C2 Tactical in Tempe. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org. Partly cloudy skies around the valley at this hour. That will stick with us through the evening hours when we expect low temperatures to be around 60. And then for tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high of 79, becoming mostly sunny this weekend, looking for temperatures to be in the lower to mid-70s. Currently, relative humidity is at 36%. It's partly cloudy and 80 degrees. You're listening to the show on KJZZ, a combination of local, national, and international news and culture.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic Cancer Center, where teams of experts work together to care for each cancer patient as an individual. Learn more at mayoclinic.org/cancer.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is urging President Obama not to use his executive authority to overhaul the immigration system before Congress approves a stopgap measure to keep the government operating past December 11th. The New York Times reports the actions Obama is anticipating making would protect up to 5 million undocumented immigrants from the threat of deportation. The president is pressing the president of Myanmar, also known as Burma, to keep moving that country toward full democracy. The two leaders met today.
Specifically, we had the opportunity to discuss elections that are scheduled for next year and the need for those elections to be fair, inclusive, transparent.
Obama says Myanmar's transition to democracy is incomplete, but he says he's still optimistic about the Southeast Asian nation's future. China is offering its neighbors in that region $20 billion in loans for infrastructure projects. NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Beijing reports this follows China's pledge this week to set up a $40 billion fund to build infrastructure connecting China to Central and Southeast Asian nations.
At a summit meeting in Myanmar, Chinese Premier Li Keqiang told the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, that China is willing to sign a treaty of friendship and cooperation. Li also offered $480 million for poverty reduction in less developed ASEAN member states. But he also made it clear that China wants to settle its maritime disputes with claimants in the South China Sea individually and not through ASEAN. The ASEAN summit produced a statement expressing concern about tensions in the South China Sea without mentioning China. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
A new government report says sloppy care of contact lenses is the main reason for hundreds of thousands of eye infections each year. Most cases of keratitis, which is an infection of the cornea, are mild, but a very small number are severe. Wall Street, the Dow is up 40 points today. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at cancercenter.com. This is KJZZ.
Nowadays, it's not a question of whether you have a mobile phone. It's more a question of which phone you have. Prices have fallen and more people across the world are now able to get their hands on them. But as we rush to get the latest gadgets, what happens to all our old phones? The answer is many of them are finding their way to Africa, where the environment is suffering as a result. The BBC's Thomason Ford reports from Abidjan in Ivory Coast.
This is the Marché Noir, the black market. It's packed with rows of stalls, all just selling one thing, mobile phones. Everything from this old trusty Nokia that simply just texts and calls to the latest smartphone that's more like a handheld computer. And they're cheap, really cheap. This smartphone here will set you back as little as $8.
But as more people want the latest model, more phones are being thrown away. Phone repairman Adu Felicien negotiates a price with a customer. He sits in his shack, surrounded by sacks of old phone parts. Wires and bits of broken phones are sprawled on the desk in front of him.
We throw the waste in the bin just to get rid of it, because it hangs around the streets in the reach of children.
Even with hundreds of repair shops, like Felicien's, thousands of phones and phone parts are still being thrown away. And a lot of them end up in here, in the Abrier Lagoon in the heart of the city. It's the end of the journey for much of Abidjan's waste, where it either festers or gets washed out to sea. From afar, it looks beautiful, but as you get up close, you can see the litter, and the smell is incredible. A mixture of sewage, rotting food, and just generally foul-smelling stuff. And this is the problem. The waste, if it's not dealt with, can become a toxic hazard. Staff at Ivory Coast's first mobile phone recycling centre sort through bags of broken phones. They collect them from repair shops, paying per kilo. Everything is separated, the plastic, the batteries, the screens and the electrical parts. Isabelle Gabou, the director of the Electronic Waste Project, shows me around.
It's really important to recycle because more and more we're realising we are suffering from diseases that we can't explain. We are not a rich country. We are a developing country. So for me, it is very important because it will enable people to be doing better.
The waste is packed up and sent to France for recycling. The first shipment left the country in July, and the second is due at the beginning of next year. Funded by mobile phone operator Orange, it's now their fifth centre in Africa. Back at Felicien's shop, he tells me they no longer throw anything away. Everything is saved and then sold to the centre. They make a bit of money and at the same time stop worrying about the kids picking through the dangerous waste. West Africa is known as the world's main dumping ground for electronic waste. Ivory Coast is doing its part to turn this around. But recycling facilities like this are still very rare. It may have already collected 10 tonnes of old mobile phones, but it's estimated that is less than 1% of the total waste out there.
That's the BBC's Thomason Ford in Ivory Coast.
The U.S. and China this week agreed to get rid of tariffs on many high-tech products, including GPS systems and medical devices. It's called the Information Technology Agreement, and it had been held up over concerns from China over products that would be excluded from the deal. It still needs approval from the World Trade Organization, but Arnold Maltz with the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU says it should be a boon to manufacturing in Arizona.
The principal player, of course, at least the big one we all think about, is Intel. Because their fabs are making chips that, at this point, if they're brought into China, and granted, they don't make all the China chips here. They have operations in China itself. But the chips that might come out of these fabs would then be lower priced because they would not have the tariffs added onto them. And then medical device manufacturers as well, and anybody else who's kind of in that range. The other piece of that, of course, is whether we're going to bring in more stuff from China. And probably not. I wouldn't think we would bring in stuff so much more from China at this point, because I don't think that we're necessarily looking at stuff we don't already bring in from China.
One of the talking points that supporters, including the White House, have been mentioning is that this will be a boon for manufacturing jobs. And I'm curious if that means that there will be more manufacturing jobs among companies that are already manufacturing, or if this might lead to new manufacturers making things that can then be sold to China?
My guess is it's primarily going to be for existing guys. Starting up a new fab is a very expensive operation, if that's what you're looking at. And even some of the other things that we're talking about, whether it be medical devices or GPS systems, are typically the province of fairly large manufacturers. If you're a startup medical device operation, I suppose there's a possibility that this would be some help to you.
But this will most likely, you think, affect the big players in manufacturing as opposed to some of the smaller ones.
That's what I would guess. Now, it is true, and it's only fair to say that certainly Silicon Valley and probably our startups here in town tend to be global from day one, much more than they used to be. And if there's somebody who's particularly concerned about going global from day one, again, I will use the medical device operation manufacturer, those folks may have an easier time. They may look at China almost from day one rather than waiting to see how it goes. Now, let's remember that just because the tariffs are lifted doesn't mean that you don't have to get certified over there.
Are there other countries with whom we have these kinds of tariffs other than China?
Yes. I mean, this tariff in particular, it's what's called the Information Technology Agreement, and it covers, as far as I can tell, about 54 countries.
So this means that, assuming that the other countries sign off, this could be opening markets beyond China. It could be several other countries with whom Arizona manufacturers or American manufacturers could be doing business.
It absolutely could, but let's be honest, if you're looking at electronics, China's certainly the big news.
Arnold Maltz is an associate professor of supply chain management at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU.
Those clouds are sticking around the valley at this hour. We're expecting them to stick around at least through tonight, when overnight lows will be around 60 degrees. And then for tomorrow, we'll cool off a bit more. It'll be partly cloudy with a high of 78. Currently 80 degrees at KJZZ. One thing in traffic to tell you about, it's the 202 eastbound, the Red Mountain Freeway at McClintock. A collision is blocking the center lane.
KJZZ is supported by Camelback Volkswagen on Camelback Road and 15th Street in Phoenix, offering a full inventory of new Volkswagens and a wide variety of used cars. Online 24/7 at camelbackvw.com.
ASU officially broke ground this morning on its new downtown law school building, even though construction on the $129 million project on the corner of Taylor and First Street started over the summer. The Arizona Center for Law Society is scheduled to open for classes by August 2016 and will add another component to ASU's downtown footprint. For more on the relationship between university and city, we turn to Edward Jensen. He's an urban policy consultant in downtown Phoenix and an ASU graduate we met at Civic Space Park.
The impact that ASU has had on downtown Phoenix is certainly a tremendous impact. The degree and the extent of that impact, I think, has been debated in a lot of circles. I think the renaissance of downtown Phoenix has been assisted by ASU. I wouldn't say ASU has been the only entity in charge of making downtown better, but I think a lot of the things that we enjoy as urban life, density, activity, parks, I think light rail has been benefited by having lots of students traveling between Tempe and downtown Phoenix. And I think just the density that the campus brings and the students, faculty, and staff that are affiliated with the downtown campus, now living and working in downtown Phoenix as a sort of urban laboratory.
So will adding the law school to all that just increase all of that, or do you think it might have some kind of other impact?
I think it's a bit early to make that judgment call. I think if done right, it will have a positive impact. I think there are some things ASU needs to rethink when it comes to how it handles the downtown Phoenix campus that aren't necessarily the same in, you know, Tempe or West or Polytechnic. In the community, we need to be a bit mindful about keeping the pressure on ASU to keep their buildings open to the public. And I think if we can keep the pressure, we on the outside can keep the pressure on ASU to be open and be urban serving, then I think the result will be positive. But if ASU just decides to close off its campus and say this is for students or faculty or for university affiliates only, then things can go downhill very quickly.
Among friends of yours, colleagues, you know, people who do what you do, how big of a topic of discussion is the law school opening up, more students coming here, the number of students that are here already in this community?
It's not much of a topic of conversation, to be honest, but there are conversations that are happening on this. I think the law school is going to be a welcome addition to downtown. I am a proponent of creating something called a university district. Most urban areas have a university district, and we certainly have one here with both ASU and the University of Arizona Biomedical Campus. again, if done right, if programmed right, if the space is policed appropriately to the context of an urban setting and it remains open to the public, I think it will be a great asset to the community. It's great that we're bringing people here with ASU, but we have to give them reasons to stay after their 4-year or 6-year experience. Having gone to ASU, a lot of friends that I made there came here from other places, and they went either back home or to other places when they left. And the city needs to do a better job of keeping the young people here. And that will be the true judgment of success on not only the law school, but any university expansion in downtown Phoenix.
Edward Jensen is an urban policy consultant in downtown Phoenix.
The idea of public speaking makes a lot of people very nervous. What will I say? How will I say it? Will people laugh at the right times? Will they just start looking at their phones? The Valley's phonetic spit wants to get to kids early to make them comfortable with publicly expressing some of their most personal feelings, even as it seems the world is against them. Tomas Stanton is co-founder of Phonetic Spit. He had dropped out of high school, but by his mid-20s, he was excelling in the real estate business.
The Boys and Girls Club that I went to growing up, I went back to become a basketball coach. And they thought I'd made it. You know, I was like, look at this kid. He didn't graduate high school. He's figured out, you know, how to make a success out of his life. And so they invited me to speak about my story at some big event that they had. I thought this would be easy. Go speak about my story, speak from my heart. And little did I know that public speaking was not as easy as just showing up and speaking.
For you, going to a poetry open mic had a big impact.
What happened was not only did I find my voice, like literally becoming a better public speaker, becoming more comfortable with it, but I found this platform to find myself, to really, you know, when you start writing and you start listening to other people and you start writing and telling your story, you start to really, you know, uncover all of these things that, you know, had been plaguing me for forever. You know, these fears, these insecurities, questions that I had about the world. And so I really just started to find myself through spoken word poetry. And something really amazing happened there when it was not only did I find my voice and the confidence in my voice, I also found myself. That combination really set me on the fast track.
Extra, extra, read all about it. In the headlines is where you're guaranteed to find a little bit of war. Oh, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Fear, did you get your flu shot? Because I got mine. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Stress. Depression, recession, obsession with material fallacies, Hollywood realities, paranoia and anxiety were prescription solutions and the only side effect.
How do you get kids who are having similar challenges to what you had as a young man and they see you now, how do you get them to believe and trust that you actually experienced what they're experiencing now? Because teenagers so often will say, yeah, you don't understand me, you're not going to get that.
Spoken word poetry is very powerful. It's a very performative type of art that's rooted in what we say, you know, your truth. And so I've written pieces that talk about my experience and who I am that I really think highlight not only the story, but also this amazing platform, which is spoken word poetry, which is very entertaining. I've been told that I'm very entertaining and very captivating in terms of performance. So I think that helps because young people, they, unless you catch their attention right off the bat, they're not interested. They're not going to listen to you. So we have the gift, you know, and the blessing to be able to go in and perform and catch their attention, get them listening to our stories and really unveil to them this truly transparent story. This is who I am. This is what I'm giving to you. No holds bar, no holding back.
Tomas Stanton, co-founder of Phonetic Spit. The group will be at the Mesa Arts Center on Friday and Saturday as part of All City Poetry Slam Bouts, leading to the championship spoken word battle on Saturday night. Hey Imagine if the roads we drive on were actually producing energy. In the Netherlands, this concept is being applied to bicycle lanes. The first such public solar cycle lane opened yesterday.
It's designed to turn the sun's energy into electricity. The Netherlands has thousands of miles of bicycle lanes. It could be significant. Designers say just 330 feet of cycle lane there has the potential to generate enough electricity to power three homes.
The BBC's Anna Holligan got on her bike and tried out the new cycle lane for this report.
In the Netherlands, there are more bikes than people, and now they're channeling this pedal power to generate energy. The path I'm cycling on now is made of rows of crystalline silicon solar cells encased in concrete and covered with a translucent layer of tempered glass. It's treated to help the dirt run off and also to try to capture more sunlight, but it's still not as effective as the solar panels that you see on homes. According to the designers, 100 metres has the potential to generate enough electricity to power three homes. It cost around 3 million euros and is mostly funded by the local council. The idea of using existing road infrastructure to harvest solar energy is gaining momentum across the globe. And with around 2,000 cyclists using these two cycle lanes every day, it is an ideal location to test this pioneering technology.
That's the BBC's Anna Holligan.
So when I first came to Phoenix to interview for the job here at KJZZ, that first night, a couple of the folks here at the station took me to dinner at Monty's La Casa Vieja on the corner of Mill and Rio Salada Parkway in downtown Tempe. And Steve, I know you've lived in Phoenix a lot longer than I have. I imagine you've eaten there as well, right?
You know, there were ASU football games afterwards. We'd go to Monty's. Also, I went to a wedding there once. And what made it even interesting is that Monty's was a house. And so there were all sorts of different rooms. It was interesting to see how they used that.
Well, Monty's is closing on Monday. Michael Monty took over the restaurant in 1993. His father bought the property in 1954. Part of the building dates back to territorial days. The original 1871 building will stay, but much of the rest of the property will be turned into a mixed-use project. I talked to Michael Monty about that this morning in his office at the restaurant.
Well, it's a very painful decision. I've looked at developing this property over the last several years a number of times with different people. Early on in the process, I gave strong thought to coming back as a lease tenant and operating some version of Monty's in the northern historical part of the structure that's going to stay. And I just felt like it's too uncertain, and I'm not sure it would be accepted. So we decided to just go out with a bang and be done.
Was it a difficult decision to make?
Absolutely. I grew up around here. I love the tradition. I love the history. But my love of nostalgia isn't enough to sustain an obsolete business model.
What about what you're doing here is not really working at this time?
Well, we've always tried to be an affordable family full-service steakhouse. And we feel trapped between almost the self-service and the low end of the full-service casual chains and the Capital Grills and the Mortons and the Ruth's Chris. We've tried to keep our prices contained because I think most of the people who dine here are dining out of their own pocket, not off of a corporate expense account. And at some point, in order to survive, I would have to probably go all a la carte, prime, raise prices substantially, shockingly, to most of my customers, and then it wouldn't be Monty's anymore anyway. It would be some other restaurant that's where Monty's used to be. And that's really no different an outcome than selling it and letting the property be redeveloped.
Where do you think this restaurant fits into the history of Tempe?
It's absolutely synonymous with Tempe's history. It's the founding pioneer home of Tempe. This was the beginning of contemporary Tempe and of the modern era. We lived through the golden cowboy mythic age. You know, that was 1850 to 1900, and this place was right in that in 1871. All those sort of stereotypical cowboy West things happened here for real.
When you look at sort of how Mill Avenue has changed, I think for a lot of people over the years, a lot has changed, but this has sort of been the constant. What does it mean to you that now this is also changing and this is not going to be a constant for a lot of people in Tempe on Mill Ave anymore?
Well, I think the pressure becomes inexorable. There's so much development around us, and it's a different kind of development. It's not more of the same old thing. It's blue America. We've got the light rail line and the lake and the university, and there's a density and an urbanness to this area that is unlike anywhere else in the state, really. And that is one reason for the thinking here that what people who find themselves in downtown Tempe want now is kind of a different feel and a different flavor than what we offer. We're almost more of a suburban restaurant, and yet the suburbanites don't want to drive to downtown Tempe anymore.
As you said, this has been a big part of your life. It's been a really significant part of your family's life for a lot of years. What do you think you're going to do come Tuesday morning?
Well, it's a great question because the operational concerns and preparing to wind down have kept me very, very busy. So in contrast, my wife has been taking this very hard. She's been very emotional. I've really had to keep a stiff upper lip. I suspect on Tuesday morning I'm going to wake up and it'll all hit me like a ton of bricks.
When you sit down at one of the tables out there for your last meal in this building, what are you going to have?
It'll probably be a ribeye. I always loved our ribeye. It's the best cut of meat anywhere. So that's going to be my swan song lunch or dinner here.
Michael Monti owns Monti's La Casa Vieja in downtown Tempe. It'll close its doors on Monday. Be sure to be here tomorrow at 2 o'clock. After 6 years of a real estate roller coaster ride, one analyst says next year will bring some much-needed stability and will hit up another of the Valley's hot corners. That's the show tomorrow afternoon at 2.
The show is produced by senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian and Kendra Sabo, Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, Aubrey Abril, the digital team, the managing editor Al Macias, executive producer John Hoven.
For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. It's 3 o'clock.
He really wants to improve the immigration system we have in this country. He is stuck with a Congress that he doesn't like.
Mitch McConnell, chosen Senate Majority Leader today in a unanimous vote.
It's Thursday, November 13th, and this is All Things Considered.
I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Both parties elected their leaders today behind closed doors.
Also, for kids learning to read, when is a complex text too complex?
Kids spend a lot of time in school, I'm afraid, reading texts, fluently even, reading them accurately. But at the end of the page, you say, what was that about? And they don't actually know.
And a found recipe from a cheesemaker who solved a problem.
Cheddar, you age anywhere from 2 months to 10 years. Crazy, I don't have that kind of time. I've got 1 hour.
She calls her solution the smoky cheater.
First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Secretary of State John Kerry brought Israeli and Jordanian leaders together in Amman today amid tensions around a holy site in Jerusalem. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports Kerry says they agreed on practical measures to restore calm.
After meeting Jordan's King Abdullah and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Kerry told reporters that they agreed to uphold the status quo at a site that is revered by both Muslims and Jews. Israel controls the access to what it calls the Temple Mount. Jordan is the custodian of that same site, which Muslims call the Noble Sanctuary. Tensions have been rising there in recent weeks. Secretary Kerry says all sides need to, as he put it, smother the spark so that they don't become an out-of-control fire. He met earlier in the day with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, who he says restated his commitment to nonviolence. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Senate Democrats have reelected Harry Reid as their leader for the new Congress that convenes in January, though unlike in the past, Reid will be the minority rather than the majority leader of the body. Power in the Senate has shifted to the Republicans as a result of the November 4th midterm elections. Reid has been Senate Majority Leader for 8 years, a role now shifting to Republican Mitch McConnell. An internal survey at the American Red Cross shows the majority of employees don't trust the organization's leadership, and many doubt its commitment to ethics. NPR's Laura Sullivan has more.
The internal survey obtained by NPR and ProPublica questioned more than 14,000 employees this past May. It reveals that just 39% trust senior leadership, while 4 out of 10 employees have doubts about the charity's commitment to ethical conduct. NPR and ProPublica reported last month that the Red Cross struggled to meet the basic needs of victims in recent storms and diverted needed resources for public relations purposes, in one case sending empty trucks to drive around during Hurricane Isaac, which hit the Gulf Coast 2 years ago. Red Cross officials declined to comment on the survey, but in a note to employees in September, Red Cross CEO Gail McGovern wrote, candidly,